Chers auditeurs, chères auditrices, bienvenue à Radio Créum et à la balado-diffusion du colloque en mémoire de Jerry Cohen qui a eu lieu à l'Université McGill le 27 novembre 2009. Dear listeners, welcome to Radio Créum and to the podcast of the conference in memoriam of Jerry Cohen that took place at McGill University on November 27, 2009.
To conclude the day, we turn to Daniel Weinstock.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you to the organizer for inviting me. So I'm going to start off. It's not a joke, actually, and that's going to become clear in a second. I'm going to tell a joke to begin with. This is a paper about jokes. It's not a paper, actually. It's a talk about jokes, and I'm going to tell a joke to begin with. This is one of my two or three favorite jokes. The joke goes like this. In a village that is next to a river, it's been raining for weeks, and the river is rising, and there's fear of flooding. Very pious man. It's usually a rabbi in the version that I know. It'd be interesting for me to find out from people whether it would work as well with a priest or something. They go through the village and they say, we have to evacuate the village because there's going to be a flood. And a very pious man, rabbi, whatever you want to call him, Stein, says, no, I'm going to entrust myself to God. God was taking care of me up until now. He's going to take care of me now. So the floodwaters are rising, and he prays to God. He says, God, you know, I've been a pious sort of soldier of your cause for all my life. I know that you'll save me. I trust you. Please come and save me. So after a few hours, the water reaches to the top of the first floor of the house, and he repairs to the second floor, and a boat comes by of people who are evacuating stragglers who haven't evacuated the village yet. And they say, Rabbi Klein, get into the boat. You know, we're evacuating the village. The waters are rising. And he says, no, I'm entrusting myself to God. He'll take care of me. I trust that he'll take care of me. A few hours later, the waters are up to the level of the second floor. And still, there's no sign of God or anything that's going to take care of Rabbi Klein. The boat comes by, really taking care of the last stragglers in the village. They say, Rabbi Klein, please get in the boat. You're going to die. The waters are still rising. We can't stop the flooding. He says, no, I'm entrusting myself to God, and he'll take care of me. Finally, he goes up into the attic of his house, and the water is coming up to about here, and he realizes that God is going to forsake him, and he says to God, I've been a pious Jew all my life, and here I am in my moment of need, and you haven't come for me. And all of a sudden the skies open up and there's a bolt of lightning and whatever you want, and a big booming voice says, you fucking idiot, I sent two boats. Okay, so that's a pretty good joke, I think. I was going to talk about something completely different, and I probably will talk about something completely different when we do the thing at Concordia in the fall. I was going to talk about a worry that Jerry has in his second-to-last book, If You're an Egalitarian, How Come You're So Rich?, where he talks about the relationship of one's upbringing to one's moral views. And he worries about the fact, I think in chapter 2, that his views can in a way be sort of predicted on the basis of the kind of upbringing that he had and the kind of relationship that he had to the upbringing that he had, a very positive one, largely. You know, basically, he was brought up in a leftist household and ended up defending left-wing views. And what does that say about the rationality of one's views if you can sort of predict them on the basis of where one came from? And I was going to talk about that. I think in many ways this talk is actually kind of related in ways which I won't get into, but I think they are. So just why did I decide to change the subject of the talk? About a month ago, there was a conference on equality of opportunity in Lisbon, which I attended, and when Jerry died, the organizers asked myself, Joe Wolf, and Andrew Williams to say a few words in the evening about Jerry's work and Jerry's life. And in the course of this, Joe Wolf, who knew Jerry very well, talked about work that Joe had been doing at the time of his death and mentioned a paper on jokes, which I had no inkling of. Now, you should know that that Jerry told a lot of jokes. Those of you who never had a chance to listen to him lecture, he told a lot of jokes, and he told jokes in contexts which many people would have seen as inappropriate as joke-telling contexts. Now, I grew up in a household where a lot of jokes got told a lot. And in very ritualized contexts, my father and his brothers and their friends, especially at Friday night dinner, would get together, and after dinner, there'd be a very sort of ritualized moment. They were also all lefties, no question about praying or saying anything about God, but there was this ritualized moment where we would get together and where they would get together and tell jokes. So, you know, when Jerry, the first time I heard him tell a joke in a seminar, it was very early on when I was at Oxford, maybe the second or third talk I attended, stopped and said, "That reminds me of a joke." And he told a joke, and it actually had a very, very dim relation to the point that he'd been making. He just felt like taking a joke. I looked around and I thought, oh my God, you know, this is wonderful, right? Somebody is telling jokes in the context of this very state. It's All Souls College, even more sort of grand than this room. whatever you want it to be. And people who know him know that the most sort of serious, rigorous, analytically demanding arguments were peppered with jokes, with often off-color remarks, often jokes which were sort of questionable taste and appropriateness given the people who were in the room, or maybe even not given to the people in the room. There were a lot of jokes being told. And it's always been, well, it hasn't always been a puzzle to me. It's been a puzzle to me since I started thinking about this, that jokes actually haven't elicited much philosophical attention. Actually, the whole area of humor has not elicited the amount of attention from philosophers that you would have thought it should, given the space that it occupies in human lives. I mean, you know, humor is, I checked with Martha Nussbaum, you know, in her 10, the Aristotelian Social Democracy paper, when she says, what are the 10 dimensions of human flourishing? It's in there, right? It's in there as a dimension. It's number 8, I think. But there isn't, as well it should be, I think it should be higher, although they're not necessarily rank ordered, as well it should be, but there isn't much philosophical discussion about it. Now, it turns out that there's a little about humor as a whole. If you go back into the history of philosophy, there's a lot more. You know, Plato and Aristotle definitely had things to say about humor. Not much to say about jokes as such. Now, and that's puzzling, given the fact that, you know, basically what I want to do with the few minutes that I have is not so much make arguments about jokes, but convince you of the fact that jokes are puzzling in precisely the ways that philosophers like. In other words, they raise puzzles which philosophers tend to puzzle about and write papers about and write books about, and yet very few have. And Jerry is actually one of a few. So I'll tell you in a minute what this paper says. It turns out that the only other person who has systematically thought about jokes, not systematically, who's philosophically thought about jokes at any length is another fellow called Cohen, Ted Cohen, who's a professor of aesthetics in the philosophy department at the University of Chicago. You may have run across him.
Yeah.
And also a British specialist in aesthetics by the name of Noel Carroll. But that's really pretty much it. There are two guys called Cathcart and Klein who have now published two books which do something slightly different, something quite interesting, something quite funny. They basically run through philosophical problems showing you how different jokes can elucidate some interesting philosophical problems, and they're actually, you know, very good in sort of garnering all of these jokes. I might tell one in a second if the spirit moves me. But this is a very different thing. Philosophy through jokes is a very different enterprise from the one that I think Jerry was beginning to think about in this paper, and which I think actually would warrant more thought being given to, which is the philosophy of jokes, right? So basically, when you think about a philosophy of jokes and you think about a research program that might be developed around jokes, you'd want to answer a variety of questions. And what I want to do is just sketch out the spaces that these questions open up philosophically and suggest to you that they're questions that are worth thinking about. The first question is roughly what I would call an ontological one, right? So jokes occupy territory within the general territory of humor, which is quite specific. And it's interesting, I think, to look at all of the things that we consider humorous. So think of puns, think of quips, think of just humorous stories, right, that aren't jokes, even though they are humorous stories. Think of visual puns. Right? There was a wonderful visual pun the other day in the show Curb Your Enthusiasm, which some of you may watch or not, in which Larry, the main character, who's a tall, bald guy, does something which makes him turn up in a lineup, a police lineup, where a person who has been victimized, so, soi-disant, by Larry has to pick him out of a lineup. And there's 5 guys, 4 of them are white, and there's one black guy who also happens to be tall and bald. And so the guy looks at these 2 guys and says, well, it's not these 3. but, you know, all bald guys look alike to me. And so, and, you know, I mean, it's not as funny actually telling it. Thank you for laughing. It's not as funny in the telling as in the seeing, because there's a visual element to it which really can't be captured in the telling. And if you think of really good cartoons in The New Yorker or something, very often they are irreducibly visual in a sense that doesn't really bear the retelling. So one interesting question that we can have is a question of what marks out jokes as distinct from other forms of humor. And I'll come back to that question in a second. The second question, which is still within what I would call very grandly the sort of ontology of jokes, is a very sort of a question that gets asked about a lot of other art forms, a lot of other performance art forms, theater, music, which is, where is the art object? So is a piece of music the score, right? If you look at a score of a piece of music, is that the work of art, or is the work of art the performance of the score? In which case, you have a problem of there being as many works of art as there are performances of any given one score, which leads to issues. It's very interesting, and the same thing with plays, right? Is the work of art the script, or is it any given performance? Where is the performance? One of the questions, it seems to me, that needs to be answered in order to answer that kind of question rightly is to say, well, are you getting something from the performance which is different from what you get from just reading this? I mean, reading a score is kind of a strange thing unless you have a very trained musical sort of sensibility. Reading a play is a little bit less of a strange thing. If the answer to that the question is yes, then it seems to me that you have to at least say that there's something irreducible in the performance, right, that counts as a contribution to the work of art being a work of art that you don't get from just reading the text. And I think the same thing is true of jokes, right? I think there's something very different that goes on when a joke is read on the page and when it is performed, when it is said, when it is told. And I think that there's some interesting things to say about the telling of jokes, which is irreducible to the just reading of a joke, right? And it requires special philosophical attention. So those are two questions that one might call sort of ontological questions. A second set of questions, which again are very familiar when one thinks about aesthetics, about the area of philosophical aesthetics, which, with the exception of Ted Cohen and Noel Carroll, has not ventured into the area of jokes, is the nature of our response, right? The nature of our response. What do we do when we react in ways which a joke teller or a joke writer expects of us? What is it that we're doing? Is it a kind of a cognitive judgment about the joke? Is it an assessment of the joke? Is laughter an irreducible dimension to the reaction that we have to a joke? What happens when a joke doesn't work, right, and the response isn't what we expect? So there's something about response, right? So those of you who know their critique of critique of judgment, for example, Kant's critique of judgment, there's actually a joke in the critique of judgment. For those of you who haven't read it in a while, it's actually not a bad joke. I can't remember the punchline though, so I won't tell it. I might by the end of the talk. It'll come back to me. So, you know, I think that there's something interesting about our reaction to aesthetic objects, right, and different theories about what it is that we do when we react to aesthetic objects, which has, you know, as a distinctive aesthetic object, jokes, I think, raise similar complicated issues about what it is that's going on. Is it a purely affective thing that happens when we, for example, laugh? Is there some kind of a cognitive judgment? The issue of response is related to the issue of, call it, the mechanics of the joke. What is it that we're responding to in a joke? And are jokes, even though I'm going to suggest in a second that that we can suggest a formal mechanism, which is true of all jokes, is the thing that we're responding to when we respond positively to a joke the same regardless of the joke? Now, Jerry thought, and this actually may speak to something about Jerry's philosophical temper, right? We've been talking a lot about, in other contexts, Jerry thinks that there's one thing that can be said in response to this question that covers pretty much all jokes. What makes jokes work? There is an answer, right, that tells us what makes jokes work. And I just think that that is probably implausible. And the third thing that one would want to puzzle about, and this isn't an exhaustive list, the third thing that one would want to puzzle about is what one might call the morality and the politics of jokes. Right? I mean, it's something that probably all of us have experienced in our lives. You may experience it before the end of this talk. The feeling that a joke has been told that is actually funny, but that you feel that you shouldn't laugh. Right? Now, what is the nature of the relationship between the judgment that something is funny and the moral judgment that we make about that reaction, right? I mean, we've all had opportunity, we've all been probably in the presence of people who when an off-color joke gets told, or when a joke that is sort of ethnically problematic gets told, somebody says, that's not funny. Now, usually when people say that's not funny, the reason they say it is it actually is funny. And what you want to do is sort of head it off at the pass, as it were. You want to sort of take any steam or energy that the joke may have and sort of cut off people around you who may be laughing, who realize, oh my God, I shouldn't be laughing. That's actually not, well, it is funny, but I shouldn't laugh. So what is the relationship between jokes and morality? And what is it that we're doing when we tell jokes, which may sometimes be quite morally, I want to say, acceptable and even positive, and sometimes morally problematic, and it be true of the same joke in different contexts, that sometimes telling joke X is something that is morally either neutral or even positive, and in other contexts that it isn't. So, I mean, I could just stop there, but I wouldn't have told enough jokes to justify...
Can you give an example of
Okay. I mean, the easiest ones are ones where, jokes that are ethnically. I'll just say this, and then I'll move to the. Your. There's a very fine order here that's being perturbed. But okay, I'll give an example. So there are a lot of Jewish jokes that trade on stereotypes about Jews that are within winking distance of stereotypes that are actually extremely negative. So one joke that I remember hearing from my father is the following. Two Jews are walking by a church, and there's a sign on the thing that says, conversions, come in for a conversion. We will pay $1,000 to anybody who converts, right? And so one guy says to the other, Sam and Saul. Sam says to Saul, do you think that's true? They must be pulling our legs. I don't know, $1,000, go in and check. So Sam goes in to check, and 15 minutes later he comes out, and Saul asks him, so is it true? Did you get $1,000? And the other one answers, you people, the only thing you think about is money. Now, that's not funny. Now, I can tell that joke and get away with it. You've probably all seen, well, maybe not, but there's an episode of Seinfeld which I think says something extremely telling about this. It's the episode where the dentist, whose name is... Seinfeld has a nemesis. Seinfeld has a nemesis. One of his nemesis in the character, in the show, who comes along quite often, is a dentist. And he's...
Drake. It could be Drake. Very good.
And Drake is a wasp. Drake is about as waspy a wasp as they come. He's tall and blonde and, has the most sort of un-Jewish features you can imagine. One day, Seinfeld is sitting in the dentist's chair in that most vulnerable of positions with all of the stuff sticking in his mouth. And Drake says, by the way, I've just converted to Judaism. And Seinfeld looks at him completely sort of, what, you've converted to Judaism? Yeah, yes, last week I converted to Judaism. And he proceeds to tell, so the dentist proceeds to tell Seinfeld a bunch of Jewish jokes. Seinfeld is, Jerry squirming in the chair because, the fact that you've just converted last week does not entitle you, So he says at one point, look, last week I couldn't have told these jokes, but now I'm a Jew, I work. And look, it's not just not that simple. So... And there's some, well, I'll get back to it. So working from front to back, working from the issues that I raised at the beginning to the issues that I raised at the end, so Jerry doesn't actually say much about the ontology of jokes. He sort of recognizes that that's a difficult problem at the beginning of the paper, alludes to some discussions he'd had with Michael Dummett about the issue. Now, what I would have given to have been a fly on the wall at those discussions between Jerry and Michael Dummett on the nature of jokes. And he says, look, I'm not going to spend any time on this issue. I'm going to go straight to the second issue, which is what makes jokes work. But he, en passant, suggests something which seems to me to be a structural trait, which is probably true of all jokes and that marks them off from other types of humor, which is that jokes have punchlines, right? So I think that if you wanted to distinguish jokes from all those other things that I mentioned a few minutes ago, you would revert reflects the fact that jokes function in virtue of the extent to which that thing called a punchline functions, where the punchline is something that relates in some complicated way to what has come before. So a one-liner can't really be a joke because, as it were, it is both setup and punchline at the same time. There has to be some connection between the punchline and the thing that comes before. So, I mean, one thing that one might think about is whether, you know, and it's a suggestion that I would entertain at least for a few minutes, which is that jokes are distinct from other forms of humor in that they possess this thing called a punchline. And, you know, were I so inclined and were I to have more time, I would spend a little bit of time trying to think about necessary and sufficient conditions for some final utterance in a joke or some final sentence actually counting as a punchline rather than just the last sentence, right? But that's where I think Jerry gets. So Jerry's proposition about the second set of problems, which is how do jokes work, is that basically jokes work when, in a proportion which is identifiable when you hear it, but not spellable out in terms of a formula, the punchline has to the joke that has come before just the right connection of common sense and absurdity. Right? So a joke isn't funny if there isn't something extremely commonsensical going on, which is then inflected with some element of absurdity. So one of the joke that he uses to set this up is a joke which he actually attributes to the young Woody Allen. I remember hearing it at home, but you know, jokes are also interesting in that it's difficult for anybody to claim paternity of them. There's actually a history of jokes written by a guy called Jim Holt, where he goes back into the Greeks and finds sort of prefigurations of jokes that are, you know, current at the time that he's writing. But the joke goes like this: there are two people who are having lunch in their favorite diner, and one says to the other, "You know, the food here has really gone downhill." And the other agrees, says, "Yeah, this is almost inedible. It's bland. It's awful. It's unbearable." And the other one answers, "Yeah, and such small portions." Right. So I actually think it's a pretty good joke. So the idea about why that works is that both complaints make sense, right? If you go to a restaurant and the food is bad, it makes sense to complain about that. When you go to a restaurant and the portions are very small, it makes sense to complain about that. It's the juxtaposition of the two, and it's not completely absurd, right? Because as Jerry points out, even if the food is bad, there is still something of an extra bad about leaving a restaurant where the food has been bad, and on top of that, you're still hungry, right? So it's not as if complete leave has been taken of any kind of sense. So there's a beautiful phrase. My printer wasn't working last night, and I couldn't print out the paper, but there's a very nice phrase in Jerry where he says that, you know, here you have the absurd and the commonsensical entertaining a sort of dance with one another that is just right, that is just appropriate, right? So if it had been something, if the punchline instead of being yes in such small portions had been something like, yes, and they're no longer serving the jumbo portions, it wouldn't have been quite as funny because whereas it makes a kind of sense to expect enough, right, to expect jumbo would just be sort of throwing the balance between the absurdity and the sense off. Another joke, which Jerry claims to be his favorite joke of all time, I don't actually think it's as good as that one is. Somebody calls up the law firm of Cohen, 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 and Cohen, and says to the person who answers the phone, "Can I please talk to Mr. Cohen? He's off at lunch." Well, okay, can I talk to Mr. Cohen? Oh, he's recovering from a hernia operation. Getting increasingly exercise. Okay, well, can I talk to Mr. Cohen? No, he's at a school event with his daughter. Okay, well, can I talk to Mr. Cohen? Speaking. So again, it's true of any. It's again, you know, Jerry says that you have in this joke the, you know, the absurdity is clear, and you know, it kills a joke to actually have to explain it. So I won't, but it's you know, this is a philosophy talk rather than just a bunch of jokes, so I will for a second, right? There is no point where anything absurd is really being said. It is the combination of sensical moments in the joke that add up to something that is just absurd. But if you pushed it a little bit further, it wouldn't. Now, my complaint about Jerry's view is that it is in ways which are perhaps sort of a piece with Jerry's philosophical temperament, it is a little bit too sort of one size fits all, right? So we could probably think of, you know, 80% of the jokes that we've heard we might be able to think of a lot of the jokes that we've heard as fitting that model, the sort of common sense and absurdity model. But I think that there are other kinds of jokes that just don't make sense in that way. So if you look at theories of humor, philosophical theories of humor, there are traditionally thought to be sort of three general accounts. One, which is the incongruity account, which I think Jerry's view can fit into. The two others, one is attributed to Plato, which is the superiority account. When we tell a joke, we sort of assert our superiority over someone or something. It could be someone who is normally actually a superior. When there's a lot of Jewish jokes, actually, incredibly, there's a rich trove of Jewish jokes that were actually told in concentration camps. Coping mechanism, quite understandable. You want to be able to control your persecutor in the one way that you can, namely by joking about them, but also sometimes jokes that are told about people who are actually one's sort of social or economic inferiors. And then there's the Freud theory, which is the sort of release of tension theory, where jokes are one ways, dreams are another, jokes and dreams are related in Freud's work, in which we sort of disjouer, we sort of... circumvent the internal censor, right? But all of Freud's examples are sex jokes, right? So again, you have a kind of tendency. I think we have to accept a certain kind of pluralism about the kinds of jokes that there are. Now, the question that one might want to ask oneself, though, is there some kind of a meta, not principle, but a meta story that we can tell about these three kinds of jokes? In other words, what? I'm running out of time. I'm probably going to get told to be quiet.
I won't interrupt you mid-joke.
Okay. I have the book in my... I can bring it out. Actually, they're not very good. You know, they're not very good at all, really. But because they're so dated, because Freud saw jokes as being ways in which we sort of circumvent our internal censor, that which our internal censor was being exercised about in sort of, Vienna, and is not exactly what we would feel exercised about. So they're very puerile, actually, sex jokes. So you made me lose my train of thought. So the question that we might want to ask ourselves is whether...
the comic knows how to deal with the front row heckler.
I know. I'm just talking about jokes. This isn't a stand-up routine. I'm sitting down. Yeah. So the one thing that we might want to ask ourselves is whether there's some kind of a meta principle which makes all of these different kinds of jokes hang together. And again, in thinking about it in a very preliminary way, I suggest that there is. So I think that one of the things that all of these kinds of jokes do, both the sort of superiority jokes where we affirm our superiority over something or some person who in other contexts is our superior. There's a lot of great death jokes, right? So I'll tell one. Man goes to the doctor, finds out that he has a very rare illness. The doctor tells him, there's nothing we can do, there's no cure, and you'll be dead within 24 hours. The man goes home, tells his wife, and says, whatever her name is,
Sarah,
this is my last night on earth. Could we make love in my last night on earth? And she says, well, of course, you're going to be dead tomorrow. It's the least that we could do is make love one last time. So they do. And then at 2 o'clock in the morning, he's obviously sort of perturbed about his impending fate. And he wakes his wife up and says, can we make love again? Because, it's really my last night on earth. And she says, of course we can. And so they do. And then a couple of hours later, 4 o'clock in the morning, he wakes her up again and makes the same request. And she looks at him and says, well, you don't have to get up tomorrow morning. So I think that there is something in all three of these kinds of jokes which has to do, and I'll go very quickly over this, with the sort of toying with our narrative expectations. Basically, what jokes have in common is that they are, amongst other things, they are stories, they are narratives. They are short, often, but not always, sort of recountings in which we say stuff that happened. And we then, the punchline consists in sort of moving the person who hears the joke away from where the joke would normally the story would normally be heading if it were a story. So I think there is some work that could be done sort of connecting these three types of jokes together that would have to do with the manipulation of our narrative expectations, so sort of trading on our narrative expectations. But I won't go into that too much because I want to go to the second set of questions that I had. that have to do with performance and... So Jerry is very interested in jokes as logical objects. How do they function? How do they work? And again, perhaps something that is in keeping with his philosophical temper. So for him, it would be, were he to think about the issue, had he been able to think about the issue enough, the success of the enterprise would have been being able to come up with some kind of formula that states in a more precise way what he says in an intuitive way, namely that there is some kind of connection between absurdity and common sense, but in just the right proportion. Throw either one out of proportion and you don't have anything funny anymore. Now, he completely in this paper, and for someone who spent so much of his time actually telling jokes, performing jokes, it's somewhat surprising, he spends far less time, or no time at all as far as I can tell from the paper, thinking about what happens, not only how jokes work, but how the telling of jokes works, what they do. Now, here I found something very interesting in the other Cohen, Ted Cohen's ruminations about jokes in this little book, which I recommend to your attention in part because it has a lot of good jokes in it, which is to point another thing out about jokes. Jokes always presuppose some unstated information, some unstated shared assumptions that we all have. Right? Now, some of them can be very universal. So if you think about the most universal kind of humor, it's a shame that Charles Blatberg isn't here because he's actually one philosopher who's actually written something about humor. He's written about slapstick. And he says that slapstick is a way in which we reveal something about our universal humanity. We laugh about pratfalls because, in a way, they expose us in our sort of naked human vulnerability in ways that are culturally invariant. Right? If you think about slapstick, you don't have to have met much, you know, a Chinese person from some small village and sort of Upper West Side can laugh at the same sort of Three Stooges pie in the face kind of joke. But you realize that most jokes actually function with some degree of unstated assumptions about a profession, about a group, about something. So one of the jokes which Cohen tells, which apparently was, you know, all the rage amongst musicologists at University of Chicago when he was writing the book, it's actually a one-liner, but let's use it for the purposes of argument. It says that Wagner is the Puccini of music. Now, that's not particularly funny. Joe's laughing, but maybe he's just tired. It doesn't really... So why is that funny amongst musicologists? Funny amongst musicologists because Puccini's reputation amongst musicologists of that time and of that school is so low, right, that you don't even count Puccini as being anything to music, right? So to say Wagner is the Puccini of music is to say that, you know, Puccini is beneath, as it were, even being categorized as bad music, right? So, you know, I spelled it out, nobody laughed, and for a reason... Apparently, you know, people were like busting a gut when this thing got said at the University of Chicago Music School because it trades on a kind of insider knowledge. Now, think about ethnic jokes. Think about the jokes that Jews tell amongst Jews, or I imagine the jokes that the Irish tell about the Irish, or the jokes that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. One function that they have in the telling is, as it were, to make apparent to all, you know, to thematize how much we share. Right. So when I think about the important sort of ritual function which joke telling obviously had for my father and his brothers and their cousins. By the way, you know, my father would and his brothers would tell the same jokes over and over again very often. And I grew up thinking that there was nothing wrong with this. Right. On the contrary, I would sort of, oh, I love that joke. You know, here it comes. I would think of it as a wonderful sort of thing to know that the punchline where there's a delicious expectation that is quite different from the first one when you know that a good joke is coming. So obviously, telling a joke for the second, third, fourth, nth time is not going to have the same effect as when you hear it for the first time. You know what's coming. You know what the punchline is. So one of the functions which I think jokes have in the telling when they are told in a sort of insider kind of group is to highlight, to bring out, to make explicit something which is implicit and often completely forgotten in communities, which is how much we share, right? How much tacit knowledge we actually have about one another. Michael wanted me to tell a joke, which I will tell, which is because it seems to me to be appropriate, which is a Jewish grandmother joke. The good Jewish grandmother joke goes like this. A Jewish grandmother goes to the beach with her grandson, and they're playing, and all of a sudden a huge wave comes out of nowhere and takes the son, the grandson, out to sea, completely disappeared. She can't see him. And she's obviously horrified, and she gets down on her knees, and she looks up and to God, and she says, God, you know, I've never asked you for anything. I've been a pious Jew my whole life. I'm asking you, I'm praying, I'm begging. Please bring my grandson back. And immediately upon telling the prayer, saying the prayer, a golden wave rolls back in. And at the top of the wave, completely unharmed and unscathed, right, is the grandson who's still playing with his pail at the top of his wave, deposits him right at her lap, and he's got a big smile on his face. And she looks at him, and she looks back up at God, and she said, he had a hat. Now, that's a pretty good, what?
He had a hat, you know.
Now, I mean, that's a pretty good joke, and it's a pretty good joke universally, but it's a pretty good joke especially for someone who's had a Jewish grandmother, for ways which I won't sort of get into. But, and this leads me, how much time have I been talking? Yeah, I should wrap up. Okay, so I'll say one last thing which connects with the sort of moral and, so the same thing that makes jokes sort of morally positive, right, when they are told in an in-group situation, can actually become problematic when they're told in one of two out-group situations, either when there are people who aren't of the group around, and even worse, perhaps, when the joke is told by someone who isn't in the in-group, who is emphasizing something in the joke that doesn't have to do with the tacit, sort of unspoken, common knowledge that we all have, the realization of which binds us together more. But it has to do with perhaps emphasizing the stereotypical element of it, that in virtue of which certain groups are vulnerable. So I think that one of the things which explains, and I'll end with this, there's a lot more that I could say, one of the things that sort of helps to this dynamic about what happens in the telling of jokes in different kinds of contexts helps us to explain both why it is that jokes can be funny and why it is that jokes can be funny and yet morally inappropriate in certain contexts in which what is being done in the telling of the joke is not the first community-enhancing thing, but the second, more divisive, more sort of stereotype-exploiting way, particularly troubling in the context of populations that view themselves and are viewed as vulnerable. So, I mean, you know, I think that Jerry and a lot of people actually think of jokes as, you know, fairly serious business. And I think there's a lot that could be said philosophically to sort of understand both jokes, how we respond to jokes, the way jokes function in social and political contexts. And again, I'll just end by registering my surprise at the fact that it has not been... more time has not been spent by philosophers thinking about them, and my sadness in sort of knowing that whatever Jerry thought about them will be limited to one very brief paper that had a very nice insight, which I'm sure it could have led him to other insights as well. Thanks.
That marvelous conservatism paper that I mentioned earlier opens with the joke, and unusually for light bulb jokes, it's given characters at the beginning of each line of dialogue. The warden of All Souls, or the master of All Souls, asks, how many fellows of All Souls College does it take to change a light bulb? And the respondent, identified as Cohen, says, change? The floor is open.
I actually heard at the age of 12 sitting in a pew in a Catholic church, and it was told to me during a homily by an Irish priest. And no insult to your joke telling skills, but it's a much better joke said with an Irish accent. So, you know, for next time. So one category of jokes you don't talk about are practical jokes, which are seem to me fundamentally different than told jokes or visual jokes. And I'm not sure why that, part of it is because they're practical. Part of it is because you're playing on someone else's expectations. So when I'm 8 and I put a rubber snake in my older cousin's sleeping bag and then sit there behind her tent eagerly awaiting for her to come out screaming, which she eventually does to the gratification of my entire family, right, that's a different situation than watching a stand-up comic. The other thing about jokes that are different from other humor is that they're a self-supporting structure, right? So Chris Rock? Someone observed that the fundamental difference between stand-up comedy and other forms of comedy is that stand-up comedy, you're erecting a structure of humor of your own, and so it's not reactive. And I feel like jokes as part of stand-up comedy have that attribute that other forms of humor, one-liners, puns, etc., don't have. And I think that's part of that narrative aspect that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And then I'm glad you brought up Nussbaum, because Nussbaum points to disgust as problematic, precisely because it pushes us away from this humanization of ourselves. And it happens in differential ways. And I wonder if humor is beneficial and jokes are beneficial in exactly that opposite way of bringing us back to our humanity, but are problematic because that bringing us back to our humanity and the frailty of our reasoning and the frailty of ourselves happens in differential ways, in exactly the ways you pointed to, so that when you make an ethnic joke that capitalizes on the weakness of a certain ethnic group, you are not only trying to highlight their weakness, but you're trying to exclude yourself from that very set of weaknesses.
Right. Yeah. No, there's a lot of what you said, and a lot of it I'll just take on. It's wonderful that you heard that joke in an Irish Catholic church, and of course, you know, why shouldn't you, right? It's the same thing. I'm particularly interested in jokes as verbal entities, right? As verbal entities, and in thinking about the jokes that I knew in preparation for this talk, I sort of came up with three categories, which you could term the formula jokes, which are like knock-knock jokes or light bulb jokes, you know, where there's a sort of set formula and there's a variation within the formula. It's not so much a story as kind of it's almost conceptual in a way. Then there's the jokes that I'm particularly interested in, which are the ones that I heard the most, which are sort of story jokes, but compact story jokes where there isn't much time. And then there's the shaggy dog jokes, right? The shaggy dog jokes, where part of the humor comes from the joke actually being drawn out, you know, and the artistry of the joke being just how long someone can draw it out. So there's a wonderful one about, I won't draw it out, there's a wonderful one about somebody stopping a cab on the corner of Broadway and 86th Street and saying, take me to Palmer House. And the taxi driver says, the Palmer House is in Chicago. And the guy says, yes, yes, yes. And so you could draw out the interaction between the cabbie and the, you know, about the money and how much money it's going to cost. He brings out his wad, and he's $100, $200, $300. So finally, he drives him to Chicago, and the joke gets drawn out as you describe all the twists and turns. He takes the bridge, and he takes this, and that, still, finally he gets to Palmer House. At this point, you could have like a good joke teller could be 5 minutes in, right? He gets to Palmer House, lets the guy out, the guy pays him. The door hasn't even shut, and these two women say, wait, we want to go to, and then cites an address in Brooklyn. The cabbie says, sorry, I don't go to Brooklyn. So you know, shaggy dog jokes, part of the humor comes, the punchline, in a way, the humor comes from, you've waited so long, and for that as a punchline, you know, it's sort of anti-joke, right? The joke comes before. So I'm interested in the verbal type of joke. The practical joke, I think, in that respect, is something sort of completely different. I would agree with you about the thing about jokes. There is a category of jokes about sex, jokes about bodily functions that do sort of bring us back to our humanity. I'm not sure about the exempting oneself from it, though. Is that what you meant at the end?
Just that jokes, I would actually venture to say that all jokes play on some sort of, whether it's the frailty of our reasoning by playing on our expectations and then defying those very expectations, or, you know, sex and bodily function jokes that really are directly about our humanity in terms of our physicality. I think that jokes that we might say, well, that's not actually funny, and, you know, or I find that personally offensive, do function in this way of like, oh, well, you know, you as a category are so stingy, or you're so stupid, or whatever, and I am not. And,
right.
And so it's a positioning of alterity.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
That is problematic.
Right, right.
I'm interested in what you were saying about this stuff being on Martin Nussbaum's list. And I was thinking about, you know, think of this in terms of Aristotelian fashion. I mean, is there such a thing as a human excellence in terms of jokes? Like, you know, I mean, what kind of property does it have to be for a person to be really good at this, and so on and so forth? Or is it really a sort of situation of a context? And to put this in a context, I actually, the guy graduated last year then, but I had a professional comedian as a student in philosophy for 4 years. And I went to see him live several times. Yeah, stand-up comedian. And he did European tours and stuff like that, did Edinburgh Festival. I mean, you know, a guy who basically made his living doing this and then studied philosophy on the side. And or the other way around, I wasn't quite sure. But what was really amazing is, I mean, he always got me for free into good gigs, and I watched him several times, and the guy was absolutely brilliant. And he fell flat on his face every time in class.
Teaching?
No, as a student. So he would like, in a seminar situation, he would try and do a joke,
right,
and
right.
He just never worked. And it was even more embarrassing because he would always put jokes into his essays. And obviously I had to tell him to stop that because, one, it got me seriously in a bad mood because they never worked. And two, they were supposed to be anonymous and I could pretty much figure out who it was. But it took him 2 years to sort of accept this because he had a serious problem with this, you know. This is a professional stand-up comedian, gets everyone going in a room, can handle the first line heckler, and in a class, you know, I mean.
Well, it's something that's been observed that some people write their own jokes, and some people. Chris Rock, somebody you mentioned, Chris Rock, you know, actually does a lot of improvisation. I read an interview with Chris Rock where he said that what he thinks of himself when he gets up is like a great lawyer. So the analogy that came to his mind is a great trial lawyer. Right, who has to, even if the material is prepared, look to the jury or to the judge as if it was coming out spontaneously because the force of reason, as it were, was acting through him in so forceful a way that, there's no automatic connection between the excellence of the joke writer, right, and the excellence of the joke teller. So a lot of the great stand-up comics, if you think of Henny Youngman and Mort Saul and people like that, actually had joke writers, right? And, you know, some of these people ended up having stand-up careers, like Woody Allen started off as a joke writer and then ended up doing a little bit of stand-up, but not that much in the end. And I actually think there are recordings, right, of Woody Allen stand-up. He's not great as a stand-up. So there are two, actually, the sort of performance aspect and the writing, the jokes aspect, I think, are quite different. But I would also want to, something I didn't have time to talk about at all, and I'll just gesture to it. I think that there's also human excellence and sort of responsiveness to humor. I think that, you know, if you think about education, if we think about the tasks of education, I'm always sort of shocked at how little attention is paid to developing children's senses of humor. And so we complain that, you know, television and stuff, and you know, gives them potty, you know, whatever, bad jokes and humor that is. But you know, it doesn't seem to be part of anybody's conception of what education should be like outside of television or what have you. That it should also open them up to the sensitivity to humor, given the functions that humor perform in life. So I'd want to look at both facets of it. I'd want to look both at the excellence of sort of performing or conceiving of humor, but also the sort of excellence of being able to respond to humor beyond jokes, right? Now the full gamut of things that are humorous.
Okay, we're going to gather the last two questions.
Okay, and I'll be briefer.
Will then, Martin.
This is just a sort of aside, but at lunch I mentioned that there's this Italian neo-Marxist philosopher Paolo Virno, who's also written a little bit on jokes, and as an alternate theory for the logical form of a joke, as it were. And I mean, again, this is a sort of a one-size-fits-all sort of thing. I haven't thought about whether or not how widely it holds. He actually uses the jokes in Freud's
jokes in their relation to the unconscious.
Yeah, he uses those jokes as sort of his examples. And so, that's the fund of examples that he uses. But he traces them all back to sophistical arguments. In Aristotle's Sophistical Refutations. That is, they all have the form of a particular logical fallacy.
Right.
And he thinks that is what is specific about jokes, is that they're logical fallacies that don't function as logical fallacies.
Right.
So
that's interesting.
But I just thought I'd throw it out there.
And when people try to characterize what is distinctive about Jewish humor, they will often make the connection between Jewish jokes and the kind of obsession with language and logic that is present in Talmudic reasoning.
I guess I was interested in especially the category of incongruity,
yeah,
of jokes, but particularly in relation of things being outside of a frame and things being within a frame. So in two ways. One, you can't explain a joke because that would be somehow to go outside the frame and say, oh, it was about this and this,
yeah,
and you've made it consistent when it was actually inconsistent. It's plain on inconsistency. And nor in the cultural examples you gave can you say, oh, you know, we're Jewish because of this, this, and this, you actually play on the fact that you're both saying it and not saying it,
right.
Sort of a contradiction. It's probably a recommendation of another philosopher who has thought about this in a different frame, would be Slavoj Žižek, the Slovenian philosopher. And he's a Lacanian, so a Freudian of a sort, and a post-structuralist. And he sees a lot of the jokes that he tells in his essays that actually work very well in written form, interestingly, are about jokes where you have somehow something is both in a frame and outside a frame. So it's very post-structuralist in that way, that the meta-language and the language are, there's a short circuit. And it seems like in several examples you gave, say, yeah. God is both, you thought God was outside of the frame, but God was acting within the frame, or you thought that the character was going to be Jewish, but then acts in a Christian way and it becomes reflective.
Right.
So I wonder if there's something very, that post-structuralists are on about something very true here, that it doesn't apply to all the jokes, but it seems, especially the incongruity between in-frame and outside of frame,
yeah.
that it just fits very well.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's two ways of being inside and outside. There's the sort of inside and outside, which are both inside, as it
yeah.
were, like, you know, the God jokes, you know, and the joke that I told earlier actually works a lot better. I really, really think it works a lot better if you have God swearing, right? So, because you don't expect God to intervene, but if he's going to intervene, he's not going to say, I sent you two fucking boats, right? So it really works a lot better because there's a sort of playing with the expectation. This is inside and out.
Yeah.
Then there's a kind of, you know, meta joke sort of playing on it. So the classic case is a priest, a rabbi, and an imam walk into a bar, and the bartender looks at them and says, what is this, a joke? So, you know, where you sort of... And that's more kind of an outside, you know, arguably, you know, that kind of joke only gets told in the 20th century when we get all sort of
yeah.
reflective and...
You can go on several levels, and some of them... interpolate the here in different
yeah.
ways.
I'd still be curious, and this is the last thing I'll say, I'd still be curious to see how much mileage, you know, if, I don't know whether this is something I'll actually pursue, though, you know, it'd be nice to, you know, as a tribute to Jerry to sort of pursue something that he will not have been able to pursue. But I'd still be interested in seeing, even for jokes like that, how much mileage could get made out of playing with the narrative expectation thing, even in sort of very kind of postmoderny sort of meta jokes, that there is something about the sort of latching onto our narrative expectation and then taking it off somewhere else. Where, so I'll just say one last thing. You know, it's always, you know, I've, you know, when I get sort of deeper and more reflective about this, which I didn't in the context of this presentation, I'm quite interested in the connection between laughter and fear, right? So I don't know if anybody's ever had the experience at a horror movie. I have a thing about horror movies. I quite like them. And it happens sometimes in good horror movies. So there's a pretty good horror movie these days playing called Paranormal Activity. It's actually pretty good. And I was watching it the other day. It's terrifying. And there was a point at which in the movie, somebody just started laughing. And they didn't laugh because it was so absurd. Like, you know, the guy gets up for the 12th time with... it was actually nervous laughter, right? And it just... The whole audience started laughing nervously. It was quite interesting. I think that there's something similar in the connection between... I mean, what does a good horror movie do? A good horror movie, as opposed to a bad horror movie, it takes you and it says, we're going somewhere and you don't know where we're going. And it's when it comes, it's gonna scare you. A bad horror movie is one where if you've seen 20, you could predict it. It doesn't scare you anymore. A good one takes you in an unexpected direction. So it's interesting to me that there is that connection between the two genres, but also the connection between the aesthetic response of fear and the aesthetic response of laughter. But, you know, that's just an off-the-cuff thought. Anyway, thank you.
All right. I'm going to propose that immediately afterwards, those who wish to adjourn to the room next door for a round of drink. I want us to thank Joe Cairns for making the
yes.
trip. I want to thank everyone for coming out and staying until the dead of a Montreal night. Thank Daniel for organizing the event. And to thank Jerry Cohen for giving us material to think about,
Absolutely.
Argue about, and as it turns out, to laugh about.
Absolutely.
What are you doing?